Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I'm your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Hello, Judy. Hello, viewers and listeners. Judy, tell folks the title of our episode.
Healing and Embracing Shame, an interview with Sheila Rubin and Brett Lyon.
And we just finished that interview. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I say this every time we have guests because it keeps being true. Mm-hmm. That was a fun interview.
It was.
You know, I don't always say it's fun.
Yeah.
But this was, they almost always are. But this was fun and informative,
yeah.
And they're really interesting folks, and they're all about healing shame.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating because if you think about shame, well, I'll just invite you to, you know, watch the interview, folks, because when you think about shame, you may be thinking things that they go well beyond probably what you're thinking. Let me be...
Very much so. Yeah.
Be provocative that way. Think about that. Before we do that, let's put in our usual plugs for our wonderful things that we are plugging.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you want to start with?
Well, why don't we start with the book that started it all?
Indeed, let's do that.
Okay, and that would be Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back.
That was a book that came out on February 29th, 2020. We were just thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
And the Leap Day, just in time for the pandemic, and what good came, well, a lot of stuff came out of the pandemic, good and bad,
mm-hmm.
but one thing that came out of it was this podcast, because
yeah.
we couldn't do any sort of, you know, in-person events, so
right.
we started doing this, and we enjoyed
started
it.
Started doing this.
People enjoyed it, and here we are.
3 years later, here we are, and your latest book is It's Not About Communication, Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy is Wrong.
Indeed. So those are available anywhere books are sold. And if you want the Kindle version or the audio version, you can get that from the Amazon site.
Mm-hmm.
And I did the narration on the audio versions, proving the audio versions are proving to be actually fairly popular.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of people like to do that. And let's put in a word for our sponsor.
That would be The Blue Tent. Erotic Tales from the Bible by Laria Zilber.
By Laria Zilber, The Blue Tent.
Yes.
And I will mention, you can go to Laria Zilber's website for those of you who are not watching this.
Right?
It's LariaZylber, Laria Zilber, Zylber.
Dot
all
com.
One word, dot com,
mm-hmm.
LariaZylber.com. And you will get to see more about that book, and you'll get to see an interview, a series of interviews, actually,
mm-hmm.
with Laria, sort of TikTok-style interviews.
Yeah.
And and you weren't able to be present for the interviews, unfortunately. I just, yeah, whatever. check out the interviews and you'll see perhaps why that's true.
Well, you interviewed Laurie.
I did interview.
Why.
I interviewed Laurie.
Yeah.
Well, we could have both interviewed Laurie, but for whatever reason, we just decided not
well,
to.
Well, on your
way.
Website, there's only me interviewing you. It's not like
that is true.
Laurie's interviewing.
That's true. That's true. Anyway, we'll move right along.
Moving right along.
Check
so
that
we
out.
Should also put in a plug for our
merch. Yes, our beautiful Couples Therapy in 7 Word mugs that are just what you need. It has the logo on one side, has our motto, be kind, don't panic, and have faith on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And we even have to hold up to you, for those of you who are watching this,
our beautiful, sturdy tote bag. It's very lightweight, and you can put lots of stuff in it.
It's got the logo on one side and the motto on the other.
And we also have it in t-shirts.
We do indeed. So how do you get a hold of those? You go to our website.
Yes, ctn7.com. That's CT, the initials C, as in couples therapy, in 7, the numeral 7. .com.
CTN7.com, and that's where you can get our merch, and you go to the shop tab. That's where you can get all of our past episodes you have access to from
mm-hmm.
there. And also that's where you can send us suggestions and some feedback, and we're always interested in feedback, and we've gotten some really neat questions over the time we've been doing this. And if you have a question you'd like us to address, either ourselves or sometimes with a guest,
mm-hmm.
We don't always do listener questions with guests, but we might do that.
And some comments from past shows.
Absolutely.
That we have, and that we'll probably bring up on future shows. So,
please do
if
that.
If you have something you'd like to tell us.
And one other thing we'll say before we get to our interview, which is, if you would like to sign up for my newsletter, I have a newsletter, comes out roughly once a month, and if you do that, which you can do right from ctn7.com, I will send you through the magic of an automated process, I will send you a PDF of the book that Judy's holding up at the moment, which is
7 Words to Jumpstart Your Love Life.
It's a book that really, it's a booklet, it's a small book.
Right.
It incorporates a lot of the ideas that are
short and
talk
pithy.
About, and really directly related to your love life. So if you're interested in that, who isn't interested in their love life?
Who isn't?
You can get a hold of that for free. You can also buy the book on Amazon, but you can get it for free, folks.
Free.
So just sign up for my website. Right. How do you do that? Go to CTN7.
Sign up for your newsletter.
Thank you, for my newsletter. Go to CTN7.com, and you will see a box appear that says, click here to sign up for Dr. Chalmers' newsletter, and that's what you do. So let's go to our interview, and we'll see you on the other side.
Our guests today are Sheila Rubin and Brett Lyon. Sheila and Brett are the founders of the Center for Healing Shame. Through their workshops, they have taught thousands of therapists, coaches, and other helping professionals how to more effectively identify and work with shame. Sheila is a licensed marriage and family therapist, a registered drama therapist, and has taught at JFK University and CIIS, as well as being the eating disorder specialist at a hospital and directing Embodied Life Stories performances. Brett holds doctorates in both psychology and drama and has taught at Tufts University, Pomona College, and the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, as well as written and directed plays in regional theater and off-Broadway. Sheila and Brett are married and live in Oakland, California with their two cats. When they are not working to heal the planet through healing shame, Sheila devotes herself to painting and Brett puts his soul into photographing birds and other wildlife. Brett and Sheila are the authors of Embracing Shame, How to Stop Resisting Shame and Turn It into a Powerful Ally. Sheila and Brett, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words.
Great to be here. Really nice.
We're so honored to be here. Thank you for inviting.
We listened to a couple of your podcasts before we came on, so.
Well, we're glad you did that.
Yes. You a little bit. Yeah.
So we always like to start off with guests just asking, how did you get into this work? You know, tell us about your journeys that sort of brought you to doing the work you do.
Yeah, and you've got two of us, so we've got two different stories, but they converge.
Mm-hmm.
So, Sheila, did you want to go first?
Sure. I've actually been researching the subject of shame for a lifetime. I started as a shy child, and I was always making these secret notes in my invisible notebook to try and figure out my family dynamics, how to fix my family, how to figure out, you know, what was happening with all of the different communication styles and all of the different the confusion that my family and what was happening at home was so different than everybody else, at school. And much later, I met Brett. And, we have our own dynamic around shame. But it my journey started with me deciding that, I was noticing something in family members that, and in myself that, they didn't talk about at school. Nobody even knew about back then. And I thought, well, I'm shy and I'll just like have this shy person's view of the world and how to cope with my mother and my family. And someday I'll write a book about it. And that's taken a lot of years, but we wrote a book about it.
Indeed, you did. I know you wouldn't want me to plug your book, but I will do so anyway. Because I know that some of the story, you do expand on that story in your book, which I really found quite interesting.
Thank you.
Really, any plugs are deeply appreciated.
I thought you'd tolerate that, you know.
So. Yeah, we'll stand it. But it's been a 20-year-long journey to write this book. It's 20 years of our material. We've been working with shame specifically for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And my path was a little different. My joke is that I didn't know anything about shame until I met Sheila, which is not exactly true. I actually was working with a client who wasn't getting better. Mm-hmm. And somehow I've now discovered if a client isn't getting better, in most cases, I believe that there's shame involved, that it's not being worked with. In this case, I started reading about it. I was in Peter Levine's training, the somatic experiencing training on trauma. And somewhere as I stumbled through stuff, I found a quote saying that shame is developmental trauma. And it was like all these light bulbs went off. And as I read the shame material, and there wasn't much of it, I became an expert on shame very quickly. Now there's a lot more material, but this is a bunch of years ago, about 20 years ago, a few books here and there, I'm very little. And so I read pretty much everything. And as I read it, I said, this applies to me. You know, it's like, yeah, the client maybe, but me definitely. And I have what we kind of see as male shame, to be stereotypical. And that is that I didn't know I had it. And it comes out mostly as anger. So we just had an incident before we went on where Sheila did something that upset me and I just exploded and she got upset. And, you know, this happens, you know, in spite of all our attempts not to do that. But it's really...
We could do a couples therapy session right now. Right? But
yeah.
Well, stay on shame for now.
We used to get comments on our when we would do a presentation. And we would get these comments, you know, stop interrupting Sheila, let Sheila speak. But before I knew Brett, I was the eating disorder specialist at a hospital. And I noticed that something was happening with my clients where their inner critic was like voraciously attacking them. And I was like, wait a minute. Their inner critic is really going after them. And they're coping with all these different things that are helping, you know, them struggle with the inner critic. And I thought, well, I have an inner critic too. Mine is maybe this big. So I use some of the exercises that I've learned to do with my own inner critic with the women who are in the eating disorder program. And then I realized, wait a minute, the thing we have in common is, you know, they have all pervasive shame. I had some all-pervasive shame from being so shy, but I had learned to work with it little bit by little bit. And so I added little bits of the ways that I work with shame with the eating disorder program and, you know, other clients over the years. So by the time I met Brett, it was, you know, we had different life experiences. Mm-hmm. And we both came together with our expertise in how, you know, how we each work with shame differently.
Now, before we move on, can you define for us shame and tell us the difference between shame and guilt?
Ooh, I love those questions. You want to take it, Fred, or should I?
Well, I'll start. We always start pretty much every workshop, even some of the advanced workshops, we have the students do it there. But it's always with the definitions because shame is so complex and misunderstood. Mm-hmm. And Sheila likes to call it a many-headed hydra because it comes up in so many different ways. And a couple of definitions that we like to use. The first one is Brené Brown, and that shame is the incredibly painful feeling or experience of believing you are flawed and therefore unworthy of love and belonging. And I love it because it's a three-part definition and it covers the ground. The first part is it's a feeling or experience. It happens in the body. It's not just the inner critic. It's not just cognitive. It's happening in the body. But it's a special kind of experience. It's an experience, this is brilliant, of believing you are flawed. In other words, it's an embodied cognition. It's happening in the mind and the body at the same time. And then the capper is the third part, which is because you are flawed, I am flawed, I'm unworthy of love and belonging. Mm-hmm. So it's those three things are all needed to create the shame. And chronologically, it happens in reverse, and Sheila will give the definition that relates to that. But chronologically, there's a break in attunement. Something goes wrong in childhood. It can, you know, it happens later, but generally the real heavy duty shaming is in childhood. And what shames us as an adult usually is triggering off childhood material. And in childhood, there's a break in attunement. Something goes wrong. It happens.
So and my favorite definition of shame, as Brett is referring to, is Gershon Kaufman's definition, is shame is the breaking of the interpersonal bridge. So that interpersonal bridge that Brett is talking about is the bridge between a couple, or is the bridge between a parent or a child. And when that bridge is broken, one or both people go into shame. And that is Gershon Kaufman's book definition. And for me, when I read that, that was like, the light bulb went off. It's like, oh, the shyness as a kid, the not wanting to make eye contact, all of the things that I dealt with as a shy child that I had, you know, no longer was affecting me, but that was where shame was coming from. So as a therapist, I would say to my clients, if shame is the breaking of the interpersonal bridge, maybe we can restore that interpersonal bridge from the client to the therapist. Maybe we can restore that interpersonal bridge in the way that the therapist responds to the client. And when they restore the interpersonal bridge, then the bridge between the client and the therapist gets repaired. And then the internal bridge that is broken by shame can also get slowly repaired. Brett, do you want to do the shame and guilt question? Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
It's fine. The third definition, we'll give you three. The third one, which is my own, is built on work, both the trauma work that's now going on, the somatic work, and the original heavy duty shame work by Sylvan Tompkins. And that is that shame is a combination of a primary emotion and a state of freeze. The whole nervous system freezes in shame. Well, partial freezes, trauma, full freeze, all pervasive shame, pretty complete freeze. Little bit of shame, a little bit of freeze. So that's the third way to look at it. So we give all three.
It's interesting, picking up on your metaphor of an interpersonal bridge, I've often thought, I haven't thought in terms of that metaphor before, but I've often thought in working with folks that what seems to happen in shame, or there's the result of sort of traumatic experiences that lead to it, is it's almost like they put a roadblock to prevent the risk. It becomes unsafe to go over that bridge. Yeah. So there's a roadblock there. And through therapy, when in offering that possibility, it allows the person to safely dismantle that roadblock, at least enough that they can start to connect again. But it is interesting, that phenomenon, that it seems to have everything to do with that sort of deadening of that possibility, which is why it's so related to depression. I think you point that out in the book as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, very well said. I mean, the deadening that happens and the rejection, the fear of fear of shame is really so prevalent. If I do this, I'm going to be rejected. The bridge is going to be broken. I'm going to be in shame. I better not do it. Mm-hmm. So you get that shame fear bind is incredibly powerful. And we, interestingly enough, in therapy, we have terms like social anxiety and performance anxiety, because I was in theater originally. I taught performance anxiety. I mean, I worked with people on stage fright and performance anxiety. Both of those are fear of shame. Mm-hmm. That's what you're afraid of, is being humiliated, being laughed at, being ignored, whatever, all the different ways that shame manifests. And then in the clinical discussion, they leave that part out. They just talk about anxiety, but it's not just anxiety, it's anxiety and shame.
Shame is also, shame is, I think Brusick said that shame is also the stopping of pleasure. So when somebody starts to get too excited or too pleasureful and they go into shame, there's a misattunement. That can be shame as well. And so when I work with couples and one or both of them, they're excited about the date or they're excited about something, and then there's a misattunement and then there's shame. And I explain to them that is one of the definitions of shame, and to be able to normalize it so that they don't keep sliding down that slope of shame and more shame, and the freezing of the nervous system is really upsetting to everybody.
So how, so let's pick up the question about shame versus guilt.
Yeah.
How do you differentiate between those two?
Okay. This is one of my things. I really like doing this. Shame and guilt are quite different. They're on this, guilt is on the shame spectrum. Shame is a primary emotion. It's very, very prevalent, and it starts basically, it can start very young. There's a wonderful Gabriel Mate quote we have on one of the chapters. You know, you can instill shame in a 9-month-old baby before they've done anything wrong. You know, and it's a primitive reaction, a free state in the nervous system. Guilt is something a little different in that it's more cognitive. You have to be a little more developed. You have to understand a little more about society before you go to guilt. And guilt is feeling bad about something you've done. Shame is feeling bad about who you are. Now, the thing that makes this tricky is that people use guilt very often when they really mean shame.
Yeah. And somewhat the other way around too, I've heard occasionally, but certainly that is true. Yeah, they'll use guilt when what they mean is they feel bad about themselves as a person.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I feel bad about something I've done.
Exactly, exactly. And the bridge is, what kind of a person would do something like that?
Yeah.
How you get, I have one article on the website about, you know, I took two people, but one has genuine guilt and the other has shame that they're calling guilt. And as you work a little bit, you can tell pretty quickly which it is. Is it about something you've done that you feel bad about and you can maybe fix it or at least apologize for it? Or is it about who you are?
In one of my books, I comment that without guilt, we would have no morality, but without shame, we would have no culture. And I'm sort of curious to turn to her, because you talk about befriending shame and healthy shame. Yeah. You have a whole chapter on healthy shame.
Right.
And I'm curious, could you talk to us about that? Like, because, you know, like any evolutionary, anything we've developed has had some good reasons to develop. You know, you can't just, I learned that early. I mean, 30 years ago, I realized that, you know, the notion that says, oh my God, this person's suffering and they're overwhelmed with shame. We need to get rid of that shame. Doesn't work, does it? Because there's good reason for it to be there. So I'm curious, could you address that?
Yeah. We like to use the word transform. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was in the original title. Somehow it got changed around. It was transform it into a powerful ally. It works fine. But originally the word was transform, because what we really want to do with shame is transform it from toxic to healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Because we really wouldn't want to live in a society without shame. And we have some issues with that right now politically, where there's not enough shame.
When someone is shameless, they're sort of unassailable.
Yeah.
It's scary. Yeah.
It's really scary. And of course, it's not shame. It looks shameless. What it is really deep, deep shame from very early that's been completely buried into an attack other reaction. And that's what we're seeing all over the place right now. It's very scary, very scary.
So the idea,
I lost it. How scary it is. I forgot the next thing.
Healthy shame.
Right. So transforming the goal is healthy shame creates, as you said, culture and society, and we need it. It's basically being aware that we're limited human beings. Like all human beings, we have a commonality with everybody, which is we're all limited and we're not perfect and we need each other. So that is really a product of healthy shame. And we spend a lot of time in our workshops. And as you said, we have a whole chapter in the book. It's the longest, by far the longest chapter in the book on healthy shame, what it means and all the different qualities. And we go through the list sometimes and people say, well, that's not shame at all. Well, it's not toxic shame, but it still has shame is there for a purpose. We need shame. And the purpose is, as opposed to the freeze of toxic shame, healthy shame creates a pause. And it's a pause to stop and pull out of the situation a little bit emotionally and reflect and then come back in a new way, reconsider. What, so at a certain point with people, when we work with shame, this is advanced, it's not early, but what did you learn from that situation? You know, I did this terrible thing and I cheated on my wife, or I, you know, whatever it is. And so what did you learn? That's ultimately where you want to go with it. You pause and you learn and you gain something. And that's the purpose of shame, is to help us know that we're limited and that there are other people in the world. You know, anybody who hurts somebody else and doesn't feel shame about it is in a lot of trouble, and we're in a lot of trouble.
That phenomenon of learning from, and you mentioned infidelity is a great example of that. Mm-hmm. What I talk about in my stuff, you know, our podcast is called Couples Therapy in 7 Words. Right. The 7 words are be kind, don't panic, and have faith. And the have faith part, I'm not talking about religious space specifically, but having faith is the thing. I think I'm dovetailing that with what you're talking about in terms of healthy shame, because mm-hmm. that sense of faith says, okay, I am a valid person, even though I've messed up here, and I'm connected to everybody. We're all in this together. We are all validly connected together. That's the world is supposed to be that way. That's what I mean by faith. Reality is right to be what it is.
Yeah.
And that phenomenon that when I'm in that state, that's when I can experience that sense of, oh, I need to pause. I love that idea. I need to pause and recognize this isn't just about me. And, you know, when I talk about it related to culture, and it's not always benign, you know, there's aspects of culture that can be incredibly oppressive to certain people. Okay. But that aspect of culture is always about saying, if you're certain ways, we're not going to let you show your face.
Right.
And so you're going to have to pause. And of course, that causes other issues, but it's, you know, it's all tied up together in that notion of shame being necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Am I getting the sense of what you're
talking about? Yeah. And the ultimate shaming is exile.
Yeah.
Exile from the tribe, or shunning, where they let you stay, but they pretend you're not there.
Yeah.
They just look right through you. There's nothing. That's the ultimate in shaming.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the threat of shame that people feel. And yeah, society, we believe that there's a lot of toxic shaming in society, but there can be healthy shaming. Just a simple example, when we used to do work in person, now we're online, we take a break, and then I'd go out into the hallway with a little bell, and I'd ring the little bell and to tell people to come back, you know? And for me, that's a healthy shaming thing. It's saying, hey, come on, it's time to come back now. I'm doing it gently, but it's definitely there, and you need to then do something about it. You need to move your feet, ass, whatever, and you can come back.
There is an implied, little bit of an implied shaming there. I really like that concept. It's like, yeah, if you don't do that, you're messing this up.
Right.
We won't like you. So do that, you know, come back.
Right. Yeah.
And it's a joining together with, you know, we want to start the class on time. We want everybody to be there. We want to welcome everybody back with kindness, with the bell, with that reminder. And it's a welcoming back with, you know, if they don't get it and they're, you know, on their cell phone, or they're, you know, something else, coming back late from lunch or something, they'll be a little bit late, which is also fine. But, you know, we would prefer they'd be on time so that we can all start together.
Mm-hmm.
There's all these parts of healthy shame, you know, and the first one was to have compassion for the self. And I always do that with, like, you know, I put my hand in my heart and I'm like, I take a deep breath and I'll say, well, the first part of healthy shame is having compassion for oneself, and I model it in the class, you know, and I have other people do it if they want to. They don't have to take the breath, they don't have to put their hand in their heart, but this is just a way to model, yeah, you're doing it, and you don't have to, but it's like a way to model, yeah, we can take a breath together. Yeah. Breathing is good.
I pledge allegiance.
Yeah.
I mean,
that one too. Yeah,
we just did that on Yom Kippur the other day.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. You guys are Jewish too, so it's just so beautiful to be sitting with you. And I remember Yom Kippur, and it's like we remember what maybe we forgot, or maybe somebody else forgot, but we get to remember it as individuals and as couples and as a tribe, and it's just beautiful. And other parts of the healthy shame are just like having being able to see the big picture, being able to see this one moment of the mistake, or this one moment of getting it wrong, or this one moment of something that, you know, we didn't do right or they didn't do right. It's like that is part of the big picture, who the person was before, who they are now. We can talk about it, but then who we want to be in the future is, wow, we want to be somebody who has healthy shame, who can have all these different parts of healthy shame, and to be able to see a future that has all the different elements of healthy shame. And that can be beautiful, you know, to have that picture.
Yeah, that really resonates, you know, that when you're talking about self-compassion, it's always been interesting to me that the ability to make a decent apology for when you know, out of guilt, hinges on being, you know, a healthy sense of self-compassion, that, okay, I'm not a complete horrible person. I'm not, you know, overwhelmed with shame. People who are overwhelmed with shame can virtually never offer a decent apology. Just a simple apology by saying, I'm so sorry I did that. I'm going to strive not to do that again. I really wish I hadn't done that. I'm so sorry. I understand, you know.
Oh, beautiful.
To do that requires self-compassion, that you feel like you're a valid person. And you note the people who are utterly unable to do that often are, again, deeply consumed with shame. Mm-hmm. They can't afford it. It would be annihilation.
Well, I grew up with two parents who couldn't apologize. I think I ever heard an apology. The only thing my father finally apologized for some reason, I don't know why, was getting cancer. He said, I'm sorry, I got cancer and brought it into the family. Uh-huh. And he was at that point in his 60s. So I'd never heard him apologize for anything before that. And my mother was kind of the same way. It was a different technique, but it was, yeah, I mean, you're right about the shame. I mean, the underlying shame was just so extreme. And it really affected me in, you know, and I didn't know it, you know, it took me many years. And that's why I actually started the workshops, and Sheila said, wait a minute, I should be teaching too. And so we started teaching together, but I got so intrigued by finding out this thing that I knew nothing about. You know, Sheila had known about it for a long time. I hadn't. Because I dealt with shame kind of the way my parents did, which is to ignore, you know, pretend it's not there. And in my father's case, attack other. In my mother's case, kind of attack self and attack other and attack everybody, you know. And I learned the technique, you know, and that's what I did. And when I found out what it was, then I got really fascinated and said, I got to teach this. Mm. I was like a new convert, you know. I was a convert to something. Sure. I knew nothing about it before. And then she, you know, and Sheila said, "Well, you're good with basically male shame. And it's not just men, but with the reaction of attack other, that you're really good at the anger. You know, that's you're good at, right? That's my emotion. You know, men are trained, we're channeled to put everything into getting angry. Mm-hmm. Every emotion is, I don't feel sad, I'm angry. I don't feel fear, I'm angry. You know, we're just angry." And Sheila said, wait a minute, you know, there's a whole other side to shame that I have a lot of personal and professional experience with. So that's why we formed, you know, the unit to teach together. And we've been teaching together for a long time. It's our baby, like Sheila likes to say. And the book is our baby, you know.
Something else you've both mentioned, I know, Brett, you used to teach this. And Sheila, in our intro, I forget exactly where it was, but you've also been involved in drama as therapy, or drama therapy, whatever it would be. I wrote in one of my chapters, I wrote about couples therapy as improv theater. I am not trained in improv. I'm sort of like, you know, I'm not a rabbi, but I played one on television, you know. I'm not an actor, but among our kids, you know, three of them have degrees or lots of experience in acting. And so, you know, that's where I got it from. But the improv part, I'm sort of curious about your take on that, because I have noted that it was funny, you know, in doing, I've finally given up accepting insurance just this year, but
Congratulations.
The notion of a treatment plan for couples therapy always struck me as hilarious because it's sure I can do a treatment plan. The only trouble is it's not treatment and it's not planned. Other than that, no problem, you know. But I'm curious about your take on that. You know,
I love it. I'll start first on that question and if I can follow. Because I am a drama therapist, you know, I use kind of like the EFT, emotionally focused therapy model of drama therapy. And I'm a drama therapist. And so often I will start them in the first session and I will say, not just tell me how you met, but if you could go back to the moment when you both had the juicy relationship, when you both were attracted to each other, could you show me that moment? Because they come in and they're just like, I hate him. I'm like, yeah, I get that. But before that, could you even imagine going back in time? And they're like, they're stiff and they're like, oh yeah, I guess so. And then they're like, well, I would put my arm around him and yeah, I would put my arm around her. And so I start getting these beginnings of couples session where they're showing me the juice in the relationship, you know, the arm around each other, the who said on who's up first, the who, you know, touched each other's hand first. I ask these subtle little questions and I might say, you know, it might be embarrassing because you're you know, you've been married so long, but can you go back to that first time, you know, when you were attracted to each other? So in a very few moments, I give them improvising with me in the session. And, you know, and I would joke with them, couples fall in love with me in this first session because they're sitting next to each other on the couch. You know, nobody's running out of the room. And I ask them to show me when they first fell in love. So, and it's like the beginning of couples therapy. And then I take a little, I have this little camera. You know, I'm like, I'm a drama therapist. I'm going to take my little pretend camera and I'm going to take a picture of you on this couch when you were first in love. And then I'd ask the other person, can you show me your first, you know, memory of when you were first in love? And I take a session of that. And then I say, okay, now we can go back to the, now we can go back to, you know, this session. And I ask them some questions and then something profound happens in that little improv. I don't call it an improv. I just say, can you show me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I say, you know, it takes them out of the shame. It takes them out of the humiliation. And if they've been married a long time, you know, I say sometimes there's a lot of shame and humiliation of not being able to ask for what you want or not being able to talk about what you want. And so we'll get to that eventually, but I have a magic wand. In fact, I have two magic wands, one for the boys, one for the girls, you know, and I have another for trans, but it's, you know, it's like I have these magic wands that I can bring out my couple session and I'll say, if you could go back in time to before you started having the fight, show me what an impasse looks like. Show me right before you say the unforgivable thing, can you show me that? And we go back and it gets beyond the shame and it gets to pride and what they're proud of and what they're attracted to. And they're so excited to be doing this.
Wow.
Anyway, that's me, Brett's different.
That's very powerful as a couple to have to go back to that. Yeah.
Thanks for getting.
The interesting thing about the improv thing is the hardest thing for me about writing the book was it's set.
Mm-hmm.
Once you write it, it's done. And it was a huge thing to try to get it improv-y like. In other words, to try to create something that would reach people. There would be enough. The way we wrote it was pretty unusual. I think my first book, which I wrote a long time ago, was taking six characters through 9 months of my class. Put the book in that style. And I thought it was brilliant, but people had trouble with it. this book, I didn't do that because it was too extreme. But what we did do was add a huge number of cases and stories, actual we got permission. I think we're pretty unique in that way. We all the stories in the book, pretty much every story is accurate. It's not a couple of composites, but mostly they're straightforward from people with permission from a lot of our students. And so we tried to create a tapestry so that there would be enough different voices to start getting a little bit of that improv feel. Mm-hmm. And then Sheila does most of the exercises. She loves to, and so she put in the exercises, and we tried to create something that would be very improvisational and feeling as best you can in a book. And that was my big problem. I didn't actually want to write the book. Mm-hmm. I was never going to write it. On my first book, they printed 50,000 copies and they ended up in Australia. The whole thing was a big scam. It was like the producers, these people disappeared, all the money disappeared. It was just weird. No one was paid.
Oh my.
It was weird. And so I have this fantasy that if I ever go to Australia, I'm going to be a celebrity. You know, I gave up on books. And then Sheila made the proposal. So I got stuck having to write a book, and it worked out great, but it was a real problem for me because I am so improvisational and so much, both of us are so much gearing to what's going on.
Yeah. The aspect that I have sort of focused on, especially where I'm saying that a couples therapy session reminds me a lot of improv, is the yes and part, because when the couple comes in, they're utterly incapable of that. Right. Everything is no, damn it. But the therapist can still be yes and. And after a while, that can become, if you're expressing that, I think, enough, it starts to take over the session, that there's this sense of yes and. You go with stuff wherever it leads, and it often leads, you're sort of following meaning. And I think, and again, I'm not an experienced improv actor. You're both, but I'm sure much more experienced in acting than I am. But in that notion of following that without a lot of judgment, seeing where it goes, that's how you sniff out meaning. That's where what you talk about, the juice, that's where the juice is.
Yeah, I love that. I just love that.
It's funny though, when you talk about writing a book and how different that is. Yeah, I wrote a whole chapter that was basically scripting how I don't do scripting. I mean, I said, my first session with folks is like what do you call the setup for an improv? There's a word for that I'm spacing out on. But the instruction to folks, well, here's your scene. Mm-hmm. This is the setup for the scene. And that's what a first session is to me. Because I have some stuff that I almost always cover, not verbatim, but a lot of stuff that I cover in a particular order in a first session. After that, we see where it goes.
Yeah.
That's that funny contrast between, writing the book, which just puts it there on paper or...
Yeah.
Bits, whatever it is, books exist in these days, and it's different from what actually happens when you're alive with someone.
Yeah, and I love what you're saying, because I think about curiosity. You're doing the yes and just kind of accepting what they're saying. We do the curiosity as the antidote to shame. So many people have, shame is shame on so many levels, but to be able to understand that curiosity by itself can be an antidote to shame.
Well, because perhaps compulsively translating it into my favorite language, but that's what I mean by faith. Curiosity is a manifestation of faith. It's saying, wow, this world is right to be that. That's odd. Let's find out more about it. As opposed to, oh no, we have to close that off. Mm-hmm. So yeah, curiosity, I can well see that in the terms I like to use. It is an expression of faith. Mm-hmm. And that indeed is the antidote to shame. It's the antidote to panic. It's what lets people actually feel alive in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I like that.
And it's interesting because when we bring it up, shame kills curiosity. One of the ways you can tell there's shame is there's no curiosity.
Yes. Yes.
And again, politically, that's happening all over the place. People are on all sides are saying this is the way it is, and there's no interest in what the other person wants to say or what they think. You're just wrong. It's not like, it's a shame-filled time in our society right now. And people come in with a lack of curiosity about, whatever, anything. Yeah. And so shame kills curiosity, and shame makes you stupid. Mm-hmm. You know, you actually lose IQ points when you go into shame because it's a state of freeze. It freezes your body and it freezes your mind. You can't think clearly. So our job as helpers is to begin to utilize, well, first of all, have our curiosity in a compassionate way, both compassion. We call it compassionate curiosity. It's not mm-hmm. scientific curiosity. It's with love and caring, but our curiosity to hopefully begin to elicit their curiosity. And that becomes the antidote to shame. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I like that concept.
Yeah, well, once, you know, it's interesting because, you know, there are all these different vocabularies and you're using yours, we're using ours. And we found that by working with shame, we developed a whole vocabulary. Sheila likes to call shame the Rosetta Stone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you get down to the shame and you start to decode it, so many things get clear. And that was the most exciting part of writing this book was getting, distilling down from all the work we do to try to get the basic concepts that then come out of working with shame.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of we've given you several, but this is definitely one of them. The idea that curiosity is an antidote to shame.
Yeah, it's interesting. What you're saying is jogging my mind. And another one of my favorite topics is the difference between ideas and ideologies. And it's mm-hmm. that sense that, you know, shame, when you're overwhelmed with shame, you're not curious anymore. You also have no sense of humor.
Right.
And you can tell the difference between people who are fundamentalists in their view versus people who have ideas as opposed to ideologies. Ideas open you up. It's curiosity. Ideology is when ideas die. It's when they shut you down.
Right.
Yeah. Curiosity goes away. And I hadn't thought in terms of what you're describing there. You can look at that as a manifestation of shame. It's just too terrifying to open yourself up to ideas that may be foreign to what what you think are crucial.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, again, see, you segued into anxiety again, which is where people tend to go. Mm-hmm. But there is the anxiety is about humiliation.
Mm, yeah.
So I mean, they're both true. You got what we call a shame fear bind. It's both mm-hmm. together. Oh, that's the other thing about shame that's so interesting. Shame is a binding emotion. It doesn't exist all by itself. It binds with other emotions. And it's generally designed to lower affect, to keep us safe by not acting out, particularly around anger. I think shame is really designed to keep us lower our level of anger
mm-hmm.
so that we don't lash out at our parents who could kill us or abandon us, which is the same thing. But So you talk about the primary emotion. So shame binds with anger, it binds with grief, and it lowers them. However, shame and fear actually build on each other by the nature, because fear involves a pause to check and then a running away.
Mm-hmm.
Think about a group of deer, and there's a rustle in the bushes. The head goes up, the ears go up, they listen, and then if there's anything they think, either they go, oh, it's okay, or they bolt.
Mm-hmm.
And shame just continues that freeze. In other words, you go into the freeze and you just continue in the freeze. So fear and shame, when they bind, it becomes very powerful and very dangerous.
Yeah.
And the part that's seen, that's talked about socially and by therapists generally, is the anxiety part. And you mm-hmm. can see how you slip right into that. And I do too, if I'm not careful. Mm-hmm. But you're afraid of something.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're afraid of is some form of humiliation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I don't hold this ideology really tightly, I'm going to be exiled. I'm going to be thought of as stupid.
Mm-hmm. Basically annihilated one way or another.
Right. Some way I'm going to be annihilated. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so part of the reason we wrote the book was anytime somebody would say the word shame, people just go into shame. Our nervous systems go into shame. So we wanted to write a book in such a way that there would be exercises, that there would be case examples, that there would be an explanation of what shame is in the body and the nervous system. And all of that, we wanted to create a book that was not shaming people as they read it, but counter-shaming people. Mm-hmm. As they read it. And this idea of counter-shaming you know, we teach with our students, and we try to teach, you know, every time, you know, we do an interview, it's like when people hear the word shame, they tend to go into either shame or the reactions to shame. And so to be able to counter shame by saying something kind, or all the different ways we have in the book about working with shame, and each chapter has a different topic to be able to talk about shame. And it's just, you know, part of it is just, I was waiting until there was a time and a platform like Sounds True that could have, you know, they did our 6 CD audio set, you know, before.
That's your publisher for folks who are.
Yeah, that's our publisher. And then, you know, I wrote the proposal to write the Healing Shame, you know, the, I can say, Embracing Shame book, you know, how to stop resisting shame and turn it into a powerful ally, you know, because I wanted there to be something that people could take up, look at it, hold in their hands, and have the experience not just of learning about shame, but of countering the shame at the same time. And I just want to show you, this is not the book, but it's a picture of the cover of the book. If you could see, you know, the symbolic cover.
And I want to mention, because the vast majority of folks hear this and don't see it. Some people do see it. We put them both. We put the video on YouTube, and the audio is what goes on the podcast platform.
Thank you.
So, yeah, so I will mention, and this actually might be a great time to segue to this.
Yeah.
Could you tell folks how they could, those folks who are not able to see what you just held up,
Where
might they see that? What website might they go to get a look at that cover?
Brett, you want to?
I thought you'd never ask. So glad. Yeah, so basically, you can go to our website. We are the Center for Healing Shame, and our website is, believe it or not, healingshame.com. And when I got that website, I realized that nobody was dealing with shame.
That is interesting.
Really, the first. Now there's a lot more. In fact, since we began, all the trauma trainings now have a unit on shame. Mm-hmm. They didn't have one before.
Yeah.
And you know, we owe a lot to Brené Brown, and we owe a lot to John Bradshaw from the past who brought this in. But generally, shame has been really under the radar. So. To answer your question, make it clear, www or HTT, whatever it is, healingshame.com. And right on the top, there's a big banner that has a picture of the book and a little thing to click. And you click it and you get to a page describing the book, and you get to see the cover, and you get to read a little bit of the quotes. So we have some incredible endorsements for the book. I read those endorsements and I said, you know, either a lot of people are lying, or we were one hell of a book, you know.
It must be a pretty good book, right?
Yeah, right. It was what convinced me, you know, because you never know. This is our first attempt. We decided to train therapists and coaches and helpers because it's easier. And also we would reach more people. Mm-hmm. I was terrified of trying to do a big group on shame.
Mm.
Because it's such a loaded emotion. It's so powerful. That's the problem with shame, is that it's too powerful for its own good. It should be useful, and instead it takes us over.
Yeah.
It's something in the nature of it. It's like a snake has that incredible venom that can kill a person, and all it needs is to kill a little mouse. Mm-hmm. You know, shame is really designed to keep us safe, mm-hmm. and yet, boom, it just does so much to hurt us. So I lost my train of thought.
Yeah, we wrote this book in such a way that each chapter is counter-shaming and the cover is counter-shaming, and it has the rays coming out of a sun, and the, you know, if the center says Embracing Shame by Brett Lyon and Sheila Rubin, how to stop resisting shame and turn it into a powerful ally. Mm-hmm. And that is really the missing piece, because we don't want to embrace shame until we can figure out how to stop resisting it and turn it into a powerful ally with all of the, you know, I believe there's an evolutionary purpose of shame. I believe there's all the different ways of working with shame, and each chapter goes into great detail about all of the different people we've worked with and all of the different ways that people have, you know, healed their shame and, you know, come out the other end with, you know, good self-esteem and transformational quality. And shame is such a, it comes on the nervous system to freeze us. And then if we stay in that freeze, the action tendency of shame is to freeze.
Mm-hmm. So then we need to find
ways and disappear. And we need to find ways, and we've found ways in the book, to have the person come out of the freeze, read the next chapter, do the exercises. And it is brilliantly written in such a way that somebody can read it without going into shame. And
I've noticed you do attend to that quite a lot as you write it.
That was Sheila's main concern. She kept putting that in. I tend to be more male and direct, you know. Uh-huh. She kept saying, oh, we need this in here, you know, and put your hands on your heart and take a breath. And, and you know, really, really, I think that was your main concern, was making sure that people didn't go. And I guess that's been ours, too. That's, you know, when you move from therapists who have a certain distance, because they're going there, at least they're working with us ostensibly to help their clients, although you can't get the work done if you don't work on your own shame. You can't help a client with shame if you haven't worked on your own, because it's going to trigger your shame, and then you're stuck in shame. And what shame is for a therapist is, I'm a lousy therapist. Mm-hmm. That's what therapists or coaches go right away. There's something wrong with me. I'm not doing right. Well, it must be the client. They must be resisting.
Mm-hmm.
Resistance is a wonderful attack of the word. You know, it's a word that people use to not look at what maybe they're not doing well.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, we both believe in Peter Levine's concept that, and I don't think it's just his, that resistance is resourcing. Mm-hmm. If someone can say, no, I don't want to do that, you as a helper should get a big smile and say, oh, okay, and why don't you want to do that? Let's talk about that, you know?
And because the trauma therapy concept of ACT hunger, that we have these parts of us that have been waiting for a long time with the ACT hunger of reaching forward, having different roles that were not allowed because of the shame, but the ACT hunger that has been hidden in the body or in the nervous system or in the person's psyche. We gently, gently, gently work with them in this book so that the person can get some of this out into the world, and they can have more of a connection, a healthy connection with their shame.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. Been great to learn about your work, and we'll put your website in the notes for this particular episode.
Thank you.
So thanks for doing it.
You're so welcome.
Just our pleasure. We're out of time already, huh? Okay.
We are indeed.
Really, really.
Yes, great. We're ending. For those who can't see this, we're ending with our hands on our hearts.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Our pleasure, really. A joy.
Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as we did with Brett and Sheila, and learned something about shame and how it doesn't have to always be a negative.
Yeah, that idea of shame as something that makes you take a pause, mm-hmm. as a healthy thing to do, a pause and recognize that it's not just me, it's like me in connection with everybody else, and that's mm-hmm. what shame is a lot about.
Right, and you'll learn more when you read their book.
Yep. Which I do recommend.
Mm-hmm.
So before we go, let's just briefly mention, speaking about reading books, I got a couple of books you can find on the website.
Yeah.
And our sponsor, Laria Zilber's, got a great book that mm-hmm. you can find on her website, lariazilber.com.
All this reading.
It's all good stuff. Right.
And you know, you can also listen to it because they're all on Audible Books.
Yep.
And on your Kindle.
And let me put in a plug. Those of you who made it this far in this episode, perhaps must be our diehard fans. I want to put in a plug for the fact that Judy and I are doing some presentations at two different local synagogues here in the Burlington area. Mm-hmm. On October 15th, this is 2023 for those of you who may be watching this, God knows when.
Or listening.
October 15th, 2023, we will be giving a presentation at Ojave Tzedek Synagogue in Burlington, Vermont, called Jewish Perspectives on Sex. Mm-hmm. And so we invite you to come to that. And actually, to do that, you need to go to the Ojave Tzedek website and sign up for it. On November 19th, we are going to do that same presentation at Temple Sinai in South Burlington, Vermont as well. We've also not complete, the details aren't in yet, but we're going to be doing it in Florida sometime in February, I believe. Mm-hmm. And we're in the process of setting up some other times as well. So if you're interested in having us do that at your organization, we can either travel there, if you pay us a lot of money to travel there, or we could do it by Zoom as well. We can Zoom in as well, and that would be a lot cheaper. So you're real welcome to get in touch with us about that. Or if you have other things you'd like us to present on, we'll certainly listen to your proposal. Mm-hmm. And so until next time,
remember, be kind,
don't panic,
and have faith.